in his
Blog Talk Radio.
Something happens and you change and you are different. And then you have to kind of come out. You have to have a coming out party. And if that happens to you, then you not only interview a couple of people, but you like do a whole past regression series. You take some of the best people. They want to actually do their audiobooks to you. And you start to educate yourself.
Yeah.
But what if you actually experience this? And what if you're not the person that thinks, you know, I just ain't going to believe any of that. Just whatever you got to say, I'm just not going to listen to. But then something happens to you in your life.
Right.
And things change.
Exactly. And for many people, it's an epiphany. It's that spiritual aha moment. But then there's other people like our guest today where it's not just a spiritual experience, but then there's evidence, hard evidence.
Yeah, boy, that's what I love.
Yeah, I do too. You know, everything that I do as medium is about evidential mediumship. I've always taken a scientific approach. And what fascinates me about our guest today is Robert Snow. And for 38 years, he was not just a police officer, but a police captain and a homicide investigator. Now, as a former prosecutor and criminal defense attorney, I can tell you this. There's few people that are more no-nonsense than a police captain who is a homicide investigator. And he leaves no stone unturned, both in his work as a police officer, and he's retired now and he's a full-time author, but his work in reincarnation is just outstanding. And our guest, Robert Snow, has written 15 books. The one we're going to talk about today is Portrait of a Past Life Skeptic. So I think without further ado, Dr. Pat and I welcome you to the show, Robert Snow.
Yeah, it's great to have you.
Thank you for having me on your show.
So here's what I'm fascinated is you engage in a past life regression, and I want you to tell people about that, you know, what that is, because some of our listeners may not be aware of what that means. But after you had that, and you came out of it with this evidence of not just one, but a couple different prior lives, you didn't just believe it. You wanted to refute it. So let's start first with, what is a past life regression?
Well, after I did this, I did a bit of study on past life regression. Basically, this is something that psychiatrists and psychologists use for someone who has a problem that medical science doesn't support. In other words, they say, I got this terrible pain in my elbow, and it won't go away. And the doctors x-ray it and CAT scan, and there's actually nothing wrong with the elbow. Quite often, doctors, as a last resort, will refer them to a past life regressionist. And what this person does is hypnotize them and reportedly take them into a past life. And almost always, the first past life goes to the injury. They were in a civil war, and they got hit by a cannonball in the elbow or what have you. And interesting enough, just reliving this seems to cure the problem. Just reliving it during a past life will bring a cure. And so most psychologists and psychiatrists who use this only, like I said, I'm sure, but interesting enough, I gave a speech one time after my book came out to a international conference of psychologists and psychiatrists who use past life therapy. And I found that most didn't believe it was real. They thought the pain or the problem is psychosomatic, and so is the cure. Well, they used it and mostly took his person back. Most of them, until I gave the speech there, didn't really believe it was real. They believed that, again, this is all in their mind. And but they use past life regression therapy because it works. It works. It's quite successful. And so they use it, even though most of them didn't believe there actually was a past life, only that it would lead, what they did, it would lead to a cure.
Yeah. You know, I'm so glad you said that. Because being in that group of people, I will verify that what you just said is absolutely true. And I have to tell you, when I broke out and did the show, I got banned from my college. my doctoral college. Now, why would that be? How does somebody get blacklisted from a school, somebody whose dissertation won awards and then research? What do you have to do to become a pariah in the view of the people you're around? Now, I'm not going to tell my story because I can't imagine for you that you said yes. My uncle was a police chief, and I know what happened to him when he came out of the box a little bit, right? I want to know what happened to you before you decided to get the past life regression, because you're entering a field now, right, where you are going to be talking, you're going to be saying some stuff, you're going to be doing some things that probably in your profession and even in mine as a psychologist, that's going to seem a little different. What was that like for you? And Minnie, my question is, what the heck got you to get to the past life regression?
Well, you know, actually, I was a police officer for 38 years.
Yeah.
I was there a long time. But, you know, I never really wanted to be a police officer. Never occurred to be a slow kid. But people would ask me, you know, I was 4 or 5, what I wanted to be. I'd always say I wanted to be a writer. And, of course, people nowadays, that's like saying, my bread, they'd patch on the head and say, well, that's nice. But I always, all I ever wanted to be was a writer my whole life. But anyway, I was in the military during the Vietnam War. And once I had served my time, was discharged, I got out. And I need a job. So my brother had joined the police department about a year before that, and he said, "Well, hey, come on down." I said they're desperate because they're, you know, all the able-bodied men most are in Vietnam or in the military somewhere. So I went down and I applied, and it turned out to be a very fortuitous thing because the job, not only is the job a good job, it paid pretty well with good benefits, but just gave you mountains of evidence. Mountains of information and evidence to use as a writer. I mean, because I actually, in the introduction said I've written 15 books. That's an old one. I've actually written 20 books.
Yeah.
And all but this book I'm talking about tonight had been about police work, about SWAT teams, about self-protection, about homicide investigation, what have you. So joining the police department was a very fortuitous chance for me, but I never wanted to. But I always wanted to be a writer. But think about being a writer is you just don't write. You have to read. You have to read. Besides being a writer, you have to read a lot. And not just from your field. You'd read from every field, because if you see a passage that, boy, this worked really great, you want to analyze and say, what does this writer do to make this sound so good? And likewise, you can find a passage that's really bad, and you want to make sure you don't do the same thing. So I've always been a very, very big reader, and so I belong to a number of book clubs. But one time my book club had a book that was called Coming Back by Dr. Raymond Moody. And I ordered it. It sounded kind of interesting. I ordered it. And it's actually, Dr. Moody's a very good writer. It's really well done. He talks about he had a friend. Actually, Dr. Moody, before this, had done investigation in near-death experiences. And his psychologist friend did past life regression therapy, and she wanted him to undergo it to see what it was like. So he did it. And he went to past lives and all that. And it was a really well-written, very colorful book describing his past life. But at the very end, he kind of hedges and says, I don't know. I don't know if this is real. I think it might be my imagination. And that's how I felt when I finished the book. Like, this feels nice. It's a flight of fancy by someone who wants to, you know, imagine things and what have you. And at the time, I felt any people who believe reincarnation were just people who wanted to blame their troubles in this life on something else. In other words, they say, well, I'm such a loser in this life, but that's because of a past life, something I did in a past life type thing. And I thought it was just people wanting to believe. I didn't believe it was, you know, it was true at all. No, I thought it was just people who wanted to moan and complain, but have something to blame it on. So anyway, I read the book, and I went on to other books. But a couple months later, I was at a party, and I was talking to a lady, Kathy Graben. Kathy was not only a child abuse detective, but she was also a practicing psychologist. She did both jobs at once, at the same time. But anyway, we were making small talk about what she'd seen television programs, looking around the books, and I remembered this book. And I mentioned to Kathy that I'd read the book. And now, at this time, I didn't know that Kathy used past life regression therapy in her practice. But anyway, she asked her what I thought about the book, and I told her how silly it was. I thought it was kind of goofy. It's just goofy people wanting to, you know, blame bad misfortune on anything but themselves. It was kind of late in the party, and I had a bit to drink, and I think I was kind of obnoxious. I was kind of making fun of reincarnation to her. Well, it got to the point where Kathy, I got to the point, she said, well, you think it's so goofy, why don't you try it? Tell me, she said, tell me it is. You try it yourself, and then tell me it's goofy. And at first I said, no, I'm not going to do that. You know, silly. But then I got to the point, oh, you're scared. Now you don't want to ask a man, or if he's scared, of course you're going to deny it. So eventually I end up saying, I end up agreeing to do it. And she, so she gave me a card to a friend of hers who did the past regression therapy, a Dr. Mary Ellen Griffith. He says, you make a point, Dr. Griffith, do it. They come back and tell me how silly it is. And I, again, it was late in the party. I'd had a bit of drink, so I agreed to it. Well, the next day, you know, much more alert and sober, I said, I'm not doing this. That's just stupid. But it seemed like from that day on, I would run to Kathy at least once or twice a day. Before this, I would see her maybe once a month. But it seemed like every day I would see her, and she'd say, have you made the appointments yet? And I would make up some flimsy excuse of why I hadn't called Dr. Griffith. I'd say, well, you know, I had 3 meetings and reports and everything. But it seemed like after this, I'd see her every day. There she'd be. And you get to the point, I'd say, oh, God, I hope she didn't see me first. I'd want to get out of there before she saw me. I got convinced. So finally, I got tired of this thing. She'd catch me in the hallway and ask me, and I got so tired of making excuses. I was kind of irritated by that time, by the whole thing. So I finally decided, well, I'm going to do. I'm going to make the appointment, Dr. Griffith. I'm going to go there. I'm going to cooperate 100% with whatever Dr. Griffith wants me to do. I'm going to show Kathy how silly it is. I was even going to take my own tape recorder along. I wanted to tape it for Kathy so I could show her just how goofy this, how goofy all this stuff was. So I did. I called Dr. Griffiths and made the appointment to go see her.
And you know what's funny? You're talking about Dr. Moody. I actually spoke with him yesterday. I was he interviewed me on his Life After Life podcast, and he brought up an interesting point. Like he will say, "Well, I did this," but then he always leaves the door open. And Dr. Moody is very, I think, skillful, very good about not committing himself, because we were talking about spirit communication, and he said that, you know, we always have to leave different possibilities. So it's fascinating what you were saying about you finally got persuaded to do this. Now obviously you did, and something happened which rocked your world.
Yeah, I went to see Dr. Griffiths, a very, very nice woman, very, very polite, very nice. And, of course, she asked me, you know, did I have some problems I wanted to work out, whatever. And I told her, no, I just thought that past life regression was interesting, wanted to try it. She had no problem at all. So she said she had a couch. And it looked like what I thought a psychiatrist or psychologist looked like. She had an old wooden desk and a couch and all that. So anyway, I sat down on the couch, and we just started talking. And she asked me to describe in big detail various parts of my life. She talked about my college graduation, something happened in high school, grade school, you know, so on. And I could see what she's doing. Going, she wasn't a terribly good interrogator, because I could see she was moving toward the past. So anyway, she finally said, okay, let's get started. Close your eyes, okay? And can you see a balloon? Now, I was sitting on the couch. I wasn't going to lay down. That was a little much. But I sat on the couch, and to my right, there was a window. So I could see a purple blob in my eye, which, of course, I knew was the sun coming through the window. And I told her, yeah, I can see a purple balloon. She said, okay. So now I want you to imagine this, that you're climbing into the balloon and going up. Okay? So, again, I had told myself, I'm going to do everything she asked me to do. I'm going to cooperate 100% so I can show Kathy how stupid and foolish all this is. So anyway, so I did. So I imagined myself getting in blue and going up. And it's interesting, when I was there, it looked like the bottom of my eye, there was like a little point of light below. But I just pointed, brushed that off, as I figured that was just reflection off the floor. So finally she said, okay, now take the balloon down. So imagine yourself taking it down. So there's a control up over your head, pull it and go down. Well, nothing happened. And again, I'm thinking to myself, this is her daydream, not mine. That's why. And we went through this at least a dozen times. She said, okay, take a little further, now go down. And nothing happened. And it was at least a dozen times. She was still very gracious. No problem. I was thinking she probably really aggravated by now. And I was getting to think to myself, this is what happens. You're wanting to please the psychologist. You know, after this many times, you know, she's irritated. This is what happens. People make stuff up. So finally she said, okay. She said, okay, obviously it's not places you don't want to go to. She says, now, see in your mind if you can imagine at the mountain. So I tried to, in my mind, imagine a mountain, and I could see a mountain in my mind, you know, trying to imagine it. Porsche said, okay, now I'll take the balloon and land on the mountain. And interesting enough, I could land the balloon on the mountain. She said, okay, there's a log cabin here. Can you see it? And interesting enough, I could see a blurry. It wasn't clear. They were kind of a blurry imagination type thing, a log cabin. But interesting enough, the logs are going vertically rather than horizontal. And one of my readers later told me that that was a French way of building log cabins. But anyway, she said, okay, now go into the cabin, tell me what you see. I didn't see anything. Again, this is her daydream, not mine. So she said, okay, imagine the meal, and then, you know, imagine you're here, all the warmth of the meal. And so I'm doing that. I'm trying to cooperate. So she said, okay, now we're going to leave the cabin. We're going to walk down. There's a valley here. We're going to walk down the valley. So now I want you to go back to the very first life you lived on Earth. Okay, go back to the very first. I'm thinking, oh, boy, this is stupid. This is, I'm thinking to myself, this is Bob Eustace. This is really stupid. You have got yourself sucked into doing something ridiculous. So he said, I'm going to count the steps as we go down. I said, okay, there's 12 steps. So she starts counting, says 12, 11, and her voice is getting longer. You know, 10. And it looks the way the numbers are going out longer. I'm thinking, oh, God, this is like a, you know, a stage hypnotist thing. I thought this is not going to work. But anyway, when she got to one, something really bizarre happened. All of a sudden, I was in a valley. I mean, I wasn't imagining I was in a valley. I wasn't dreaming I was in a valley. I was in a valley. Now, I knew I was still sitting in her office. I could feel the couch running at me. I could hear noise in the street. At the same time, I was in a valley. Now, I wasn't real stupid. I knew what happened. I figured, even though I didn't think I could be hypnotized, I figured I was much too strong. I realized I had been hypnotized because I was in a valley. And it wasn't just a blurry, just an image of a valley. I could feel, I could hear birds from the trees nearby. If I looked, I could see the veins on leaves on the bushes. I was walking through this valley next to a little creek.
All right, so hold on. All right, so is this a visual account? I wasn't sure because did you feel, in other words, were you reporting on what you were seeing, or did you actually feel that you were there?
That's the interesting part. I could feel a breeze in my face. And I could see the leaves moving, but I wrote that off as, oh, that's just the air conditioning in the office. You've obviously been hypnotized. But you know what I thought this was? This is kind of like, you go to Disney World, other amusement parks, they have virtual reality rides. They're very lifelike. I mean, and they're very believable, but you know it's not true. You know it's virtual reality. And I assume this is under hypnosis. This looks real. I mean, the clarity, what really stunned me mostly was the clarity of it. Yeah. I could see the veins and leaves. I could feel a breeze in my face. I could hear birds chirping. And I'm walking along the brook, and Dr. Griffiths said, okay, look down and describe yourself. So I look down. I see a couple of really dirty, hairy legs, and I'm wearing some really dirty, matted fur. And in my left hand, I'm carrying what looks like a big piece of a tree limb. Now, everybody's seen movies and books. I knew this is not supposed to be a caveman. I mean, everybody's seen movies and books and TV programs. So I thought, again, this is just hypnosis. You know, tell me, I'll make me see this. It's not really true. But then as I walk along, suddenly I can see it. I can realize the thoughts that this person is having, the person's body I'm in. I can realize his thoughts. And then all of a sudden, I'm aware this is valley is my home. This is where I live. And even stranger, I start saying things I didn't know what I was going to say. Usually in real life, you have at least a half second before you say something, you know what you're going to say. Well, in this case, I was just blurting out stuff, and I had no idea I was going to say it. I said, this is my home. I live here. I live in a cave up on the hill here. So Dr. Chris said, okay. He says, I want you to go to the cave. So I went to the cave, and as I stood at the door of the cave, I could tell whoever lived here was not very hygienic. God, it was an awful stench along the cave. Now, that really confused me for a moment. I was talking about the breeze and the air conditioner. I couldn't imagine where the smell come from. It was the smell of a person who had been very unhygienic. So I described everything, Dr. Griffin. She said, okay, now I want you to go to your desk. She says, go to your desk and tell me what you see. So you see, between this, there's about 4 or 5 seconds, just kind of a gray fog. I couldn't see anything. And all of a sudden, I'm back in a body, but I'm not in a body this time. I'm floating above. I'm about 10 feet above. And on the cave floor is a little bitty skinny man in fur, and he's coughing and hacking. He looks really, really sick. And Dr. Chris said, okay. He says, what did you learn from this life? And I said, And again, I'm just blurting this out. I have no idea it's going to say this. So I had to learn about loneliness. I had to learn what it's like to live without anyone.
Mm.
Again, I'm just stunned myself. I'm saying this because I didn't know it's going to say it. She said, now go out the cave and see if you can see a light. And I go to the cave, and sure enough, there's a big light over the valley just now. So I want you to go into the light, and I want you to go into a light where you had someone, where you actually, you weren't lonely, where you had someone. And again, this is all, to me, again, this is like, again, I'm not serious. I didn't think this was real. I just didn't believe that hypnosis could be this vivid. And I figured this is like a rite of Disney, and I was really kind of enjoying it. But it was fun, but I knew it wasn't true, but it was fun. So anyway, I fly up to the light, and again, there's 4 or 5 seconds, and 4 or 5, actually, people who are old enough remember, in the old days, you'd go to a movie theater, sometimes the movie would be all blurry when it started. That's what this was. Everything was blurry. I could see big outlines, all of a sudden blurry, and I was on a sunny street, and it was sunny, and I could feel the sun beating down on me, the heat of the sun, and I look around, and I could see gas lights and horse-drawn carriages. And I'm describing all this to Dr. Griffith. And I said, when do they think is this? I said, it looks like the 1800s, because there are no automobiles, but there are a lot of horse-drawn carriages and gas lights on the street. She says, okay, what are you doing? I said, I'm going to meet a woman. Okay. She asked me, she said, describe yourself. So I looked down. I had a very nice suit on and clothes. I said, I also have a cane. And she said, a cane? I said, I'm not crippled or anything. It's a fancy walking stick. She said, okay. So then what are you going to do? So I said, you meet the woman. What do you do? I said, we go to an outdoor cafe. And she orders a glass of some kind of special water, and I order a glass of wine. So we just talked this minute. And she said, okay, now go 5 years ahead in your life. So again, there's 4 or 5 seconds of gray fog. And I'm in this hallway with a woman, and we're having a really vigorous argument. This woman having a vigorous argument, and I finally just get mad and leave and walk away. I go down the hallway, and I walk into a room, and it's an artist studio. Doctor said, extract the roof. I said, the ceiling is skylights, and the right wall, the white wall, is all windows. I said, there are dozens of paintings hanging on the wall, just dozens of unsold paintings hanging on the wall. And again, then, like with the caveman, I suddenly could feel what this person felt, know what he had near thought. And I knew I was an artist. She said, okay. So we described all that to me. She said, okay, I go 5 years ahead. So again, I went 5 years, and I'm at a party. And I don't know what the party's about, only that I'm the guest of honor. Everyone's congratulating me and pat me on the back and shaking my hand. And I could feel this person was in a moment of immense happiness for this person. This person just felt so good. And so I described all their grips. She said, okay, now, God wants you, I want you to go to your death. Said, go to your death and tell me. But I didn't. I didn't leave. Did you think about in your life, would you have moments like that when you just feel such intense happiness? Maybe your marriage, the birth of your first child. It really was a good feeling. It really was. That's what she had told me 3 or 4 times before I finally left. That's the interesting part of hypnosis. People see these things like where the hypnosis makes you cluck like a chicken or stuff like that. That's not true. I was in complete control of myself. I could do whatever. Again, Dr. Griffith kept telling me, move on 5 years. Move on. He actually told me, move on to your death. And I didn't. I stayed at the party for a while. Finally, I go to my death. And I see I'm laying on the bed here, and I'm dying. And Dr. Griffith said, okay, what did you regret about this? What did you regret about this life? And I said, I regret we didn't have children because my wife couldn't have children. So then I saw myself rise up out of the body and go through the roof of this building. Everybody seen ghost stories on movies and TV. Everybody knows what ghosts do. Of course they do that. They rise up. But anyway, I rose up through the ceiling of this building, and I'm over a huge, huge city. There's lights in every direction to the horizon. I'm over a huge city. And Dr. Chris said, okay. He says, now go into the light. But I didn't again. Again, all of a sudden I see myself flying through some woods. It looked like a fall night because it was like a brisk cold night, but the trees still had leaves on them. So I figured it was a fall night. And next thing I know, I'm on the second or third floor of this mansion, and I'm looking in the window. It's a room. There's a big roaring fire in the room. Nobody's in the room. There's a big roaring fire. And over the fireplace is a painting. And it's a still life. It has fruit and a bottle and a big sun in it. And I told Dr. Griffith, I wanted to see one of my paintings before I left Earth. I wanted to see one of my paintings one more time. So finally, Dr. Griffith said, okay, now, let's go into the light again. And I want you to go to a life as you had as a female. And I remember laughing myself, like, yeah, that's going to happen. Yeah, sure. Well, sure enough, it did. That's about 5 seconds of gray fog again. I'm in another wooded area, but it's not the valley. It's flat, and the trees are all different. And I'm standing in front of this mill. It's like an altar. It's like a circular altar with built tall pillars around it. And I look down, and I can see I'm in a woman's body. I'm thinking, boy, you know, that kind of shook me up a little bit. I'm thinking, now, where could you imagine this from? And I'm thinking, well, maybe some, remember there's movies about people being transferred to another body. And I'm thinking, you probably, this is just your subconscious mind bringing up bits of old movies about this sort of thing. You're doing it. But then again, like the other two lives, I can suddenly realize that this person is thinking. And she's basically thinking that this is where she loves. This is where she lives. This is where she works. Her and other girls bring things down to the altar. That's their job. They bring things, put them on the altar. And I told Dr. Griffith, yeah, we're all young, pretty girls. We're all virgins. That's part of the requirement to do this. So Dr. Griffith, we described the altar to her, what have you. And she said, okay, now go 5 years forward. So again, I go 5 years forward, and when I come out of the fog, I'm in a cart, like a wagon, it's pulled by oxen. And next to me on my right is an older man. And again, I knew what this person knew, that obviously that I had been given to this man. He had given me, because when I looked to my right, there was a little girl sitting there who I knew was my daughter. So obviously I wasn't a virgin any longer, so I couldn't work at the altar anymore. But the interesting part was, this wasn't anybody. It was actually my stepdaughter from this life.
Oh, wow.
Can I ask you a question? What is your interpretation of that? Is your interpretation that she was with you in that life as well as this life, and that your two prior lives and your current lives intersected? Or do you think, you know, being the skeptic and being the investigator, do you think that your brain may have been filling in the blanks of when you sensed a little girl sitting next to you? What is your belief?
At the time, I didn't think it was anything. At the time, I thought this is just my subconscious mind playing tricks on me. The interesting part, the little girl sitting there wasn't the girl I'd seen that day off to high school. She was, by the time I had a regression, she was 16, 17 in high school. This was the little four-year-old girl she had been when her mother and I got married. So anyway, we got. I didn't really tell you the truth. I didn't at that time. I didn't think anything. To me, this is all just dream stuff. My subconscious mind.
Right, but in the reflection afterwards, what do you think?
Well,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I think really. So for me, when I'm listening to you, it's so fascinating the way you're describing this, because I love that both the skeptic. And the reality of what was happening is coming through your voice right now. You have a brilliant way to talk about this, of your experience, what you've experienced from both sides of reality. And that, I got to tell you, that is very rare. But the way you're doing it, it's very clear to me that some part of you literally had your left brain logically justifying why you're feeling the leave. But yet, there was a part of you that surrendered, or you wouldn't have been able to continue with it. And, you know, it's fascinating to hear you in the way you're describing it, because here's what I'm struck by in a minute, and then I want you to finish the story, because this is, like, so fascinating to me. It's incredible. It is real. And if you're me and you've done these with people, how do you know whether or not what you're hearing? Well, it's interesting, because you go through the process and somebody wakes up and part of what their past life was being caught in a rain and a downpour, and they wake up and they ask you for a towel. And they're sitting right across from you. But what I love about this, and the way you do it in your books as well, and the way you tell this story, is you're helping a lot of people maybe take that step where they're going to be skeptical, but they're going to take action. Because there's so many people that don't understand things. You know, if you came in my house now, you'd see more Egyptian artifacts. And I became completely obsessed with them. But the way you're describing this and the way you do it in your book, it helps people, help them understand they're not crazy, Robert. So please finish your story. I just want to remind our listeners, though, that if you don't know what you're listening to, it's the psychic and the doctor. And we have a very, very special guest today, Robert Snow. And what Mark alluded to before is one of the many things he's written is Portrait of a Past Life Skeptic, right?
Right.
But when you read this, and hopefully you guys will get to the end, there's something at the end of his book that makes sense about everything he's talking about and why maybe he, like me, why spending that time in the police force might have been part of that journey. Go ahead, Robert.
Well, again, at the time, I just thought this is part of hypnosis, again, seeing my stepdaughter. Interesting enough, she, when I wrote the book and talked to her about it, she knew things about my regression. She knew things about the people in my regression that it isn't recorded anywhere that anybody would find. I thought that was kind of interesting that she didn't know some facts that weren't really recorded where. So anyway, I go to the farm.
There you go.
I go to the farm with this man. He dies real soon afterwards, and so here I am with a little 4 or 5 year old daughter. So what I did, I took her back to the altar and gave her to the people at the altar, that so that she could be able to do it, that same job I had and everything. And I'm telling myself as I'm talking to Griffith that this is the best thing for her. This is wonderful. She'll have a great life. But what I'm feeling inside, not myself, but this person I'm in, is tremendous guilt. Because I know what I'm doing is abandoning my daughter. I'm actually giving her away because I know life would be a lot easier for me if I didn't have a little 5-year-old girl tagging along. And all of a sudden, it was really funny because I thought how silly this was when I was doing the regression. I felt this terrible pressure on me of guilt. It was like I felt awful, like a brick laying in my chest. I felt so awful. But I done this. I kept telling her over and over, this is for her, but this is the best thing for her. This is good and all this. I didn't believe it. I knew what I was doing was banning her. So anyway, Dr. Griffith went on. She said, okay, now go to your death in this life. And I had apparently gone to someplace close to the ocean or because I was in a fish. I was doing something in the fishing industry. And in my death, I was in the water. And I was my legs were caught up in some kind of net, and I was drowning. And for just a moment, I could taste salt water. Just a moment, Dr. Griffith, I'm like, taste salt water. And so finally, Dr. Griffith said, okay, now go into the light. And boy, I wanted to get the light fast on this one, because I felt just terrible, the whole time terrible, oppressive guilt for what I'd done with my daughter. So I went to the light. She said, okay, now go to your most previous life before you were Bob Snow. Go to the very most previous past life you're in before your present one. So again, there was 4 or 5 seconds fog, and all of a sudden, I'm back. I can tell I'm back in the artist body again. But now I'm in my studio, and I'm painting a portrait. But the interesting part was that the woman, the person who I was paying up for that was to pay a portrait of a hunchback. So anyway, but the interesting part is, the regression is so clear. I could see every single brush stroke in this painting, and I could tell I was just about finished. And I talked to Delta Griffiths. I said, I hate painting portraits. I don't like painting, but I hate doing them, but I need the money. I really need the money. I could feel this person's desperate need for money. And I just kept saying, I need the money. I hate paying portraits. I need the money. So we talked about it. Then Dr. Griff said, okay, go 5 years ahead in your life and tell me what you see. And so I go 5 years, and I see I'm in a vigorous argument with someone about the lighting for one of my paintings, that the lighting isn't right. I'm just having a big argument with him. So anyway, Dr. Griff said, okay, let's see. And finally, I go in 5 years, and I'm in a small garden, and I hear piano music coming from a house close by. So I walk up to the house, stand around. Dr. Griffith asked me, where are you at? And for I just immediately blurted out. I didn't know what I was going to say. I said, I'm in France. And again, I didn't know what I was going to say. Dr. Griffith said, okay, now go 5 years forward. So in the fog, before I could get to the next 5 years, I suddenly blurted out, she died of a blood clot. The doctor says she died of a blood clot. Now, I had no idea who I was talking about, only that whoever this person was, I could feel the grief this person felt, the sadness, that this was a person who was very, very important to the artist. Some woman who had died was very important. I kept saying she died of a blood clot. Well, before I get to the next scene, the recorder I brought along, I wanted to tape all this so I could show Kathy how stupid it was. The recording I brought along clicked off and opened my eyes, and that was it. It was over.
Mm.
Now, I'm kind of embarrassed to tell you the truth, because I'd gone there with the idea of how stupid those was and nothing would happen. And I've had, I didn't believe it was real at the moment, but I know I've been blabbering like an idiot for about a half hour about things I've just seen. That I knew were just the hypnosis. So Dr. Griffith asked me, he says, well, can you see how this relates to your present life and all that? And I really couldn't at the moment. I was too confused and flustered by what had happened. So I forgot my mumbled something to her and went out to my car. I didn't leave her. I sat in my car for a while trying to understand what had just happened. The problem with the whole thing wasn't the what happened, phantom was the regression, but how vivid it had been.
Yeah.
I could not only see and hear, I could feel, I could smell, and I could touch, I could taste things. And I don't know how that could happen. I thought the hypnosis must have been really, really strong to make you do that, to imagine myself doing that. And I sat there for about a half an hour trying to figure out what it meant. And finally I told myself, Bob, this is nothing. It was just hypnosis. You had brought up a bunch of memories from your past, from your subconscious mind, and that's all there was to it. Let it forget about it. Just it was kind of fun. It was like, you know, like a great ride at some amusement park, but just forget about it. that sounds good, but I couldn't stop thinking about this. Okay. And interesting, for the first couple of years after my regression, if I closed my eyes, I could still see the scenes in vivid detail. If I closed my eyes, I could still see the painting, the brush strokes in the painting. It was just everyone on. So I kept telling myself, Bob, forget about it. It was nothing. It was just hypnosis. Bring up some memories. But I couldn't.
Yeah.
I thought about it 50, 100 times a day, every day. I thought, and I closed my eyes and I'd see it. I thought about it constantly, just constantly. And I knew I was becoming obsessed. And I'll tell you, I was a police officer for 38 years. And I know when you have some kind of people who have deep obsession, it seldom turns out real well for you. It doesn't really turn out real well. So I finally said, well, you know, this is crazy, Bob. You can't believe somebody obsessed like this. You got to do something about it. I decided what I need to do. I need to find one of these paintings, either the still life or the fireplace or the hunchback woman. I thought if I could find one of these paintings, it was all of a sudden, oh, yeah, I saw that, you know, 5 years ago someplace. There was a little blurb about the artist at the bottom. That's how I know these things. I was sure that's what it was. So I thought, well, the way to do it, I got to find one of these paintings. So I made a plan. I would go to the public library. Now, this happened before the advent of the Internet.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
There was no search engine.
No.
You could just put a portrait of hunchback woman in. So
right.
In those days, when you wanted to do research,
I didn't mean to laugh, but
you had to go to the library.
Yeah, it's like you may even had to go on microfilm.
Yeah.
I totally relate to that.
Yeah, I mean, that is so unique and unusual. Yeah, because, you would think that you would be envisioning yourself as being like a Leonardo or a Raphael painting the Mona Lisa, not some guy can't identify painting a hunchback. You know, I mean, that really is unique.
But it's very real. I mean, so real, Bob, that you could not find it. You could not research it. What I'm trying to say,
I had to do it. I couldn't stop thinking about it. It was occupying my thoughts constantly.
All the time.
So I thought if I could find these paintings, I'll remember where I saw them at, then it all fall in place. You saw this exhibit, you read the blurb of the artist, that's how it all come through. So I decided I'd go to the Indianapolis Public Library. Again, there's no internet, so I go to the library. I'd go through their art books until I found it. Well, it was a good plan, but let me tell you, I had no idea there were so many. There were hundreds of art books in the library. I spent months. But I went through every single book, couldn't find either painting. Now that kind of confused me because the painting was just too clear in my mind. I mean, again, I could see every single brushstroke that it couldn't be real, and I couldn't understand what happened. So I just started visiting a couple of some bookstores right in Annapolis, the Barnes and Noble, the various books, and I thought they had art books in the library, and I went through all those. And again, it took me a couple of months, I still didn't find it. Now, I'm getting flustered now because I know there has to be somewhere. So, I started calling art galleries around Indianapolis and asked them if they knew where it was. Mm-hmm. At that time, I found before the internet, there was no center registry of paintings. Now, if you wanted a Rembrandt or a Renoir, now you could find that. They knew where that was at. But small paintings like this, and everybody told me the same thing. If you don't know where it's at or who might know it, that you're never going to find it.
That's right.
Right.
But I wasn't ready to give up yet. I've been an investigator for a long time. I wasn't ready to give up yet. Maybe I need to pull back and try some other tactic. So what I did, I went to a New Age bookstore in Annapolis and bought a couple books on past life regression therapy. I thought maybe if I understood what happened during this session, then I would then make it clear to what, you know, why I asked you what happens. I could explain what I'd seen. So I read them, and I was amazed that I learned that how many people had experienced things similar to what I experienced. But more than that, one of the books had a script for self-hypnosis. It sounded like a lot like Dr. Griffith, a lot of imagery and everything.
Yeah.
So I tried it. Let me tell you something. That's a lot harder than you think it is. Self-hypnosis is a lot harder than you think. But I'd probably died a dozen times. And only two of the times I could feel myself going into the same state that had been Dr. Griffith's office. But it only lasts for two or three seconds. I was the number 1917. Then it was like a snap off. It happened to me twice. So finally, I decided, well, Bob, when I was in charge of homicide, we had an 83% clearance rate, which is really good for a big city. But that still means every year, 17% of the murders go unsolved. Simply, they go unsolved because they don't have enough evidence. Most, and I figured that's what's going to happen in this case. I don't have any more. I've checked every line I could think of. So what we do with the murder cases, when you do that, you deactivate them. They go on the shelf. You don't really do any more work on them, but you will. They're ready to be reactivated if new evidence come up. So I said, Bob, you can't solve it. You looked every avenue. There's nothing that you do. Just forget about it, which sounds good, but it didn't work. I still was upset about it. But anyway, it was getting toward April of the year, and my wife and I had an anniversary last April, and we decided to go on vacation somewhere we'd never been before. So one day I'm at work, and she calls me. My wife, by the way, was a police officer also. She was a child abuse detective along with Kathy Graven. That's how I met Kathy Graven at the party, because my wife was also a child abuse detective for many years. So she called me and said, what about New Orleans? Let's go to New Orleans. Mm-hmm. I thought, that's like fun. I'd never been to New Orleans, needed you. It's like fun. So we planned. We got the hotel, got a plane ride, a hotel, went down to New Orleans. And my wife is a real history buff. Now, you go to New Orleans, you can't throw a rock without hitting something historical. And we did a lot of days. We visited the plantation at the plantation, the battlefield 1812, what have you. And at nighttime, we go down to French Quarter and have a couple drinks and listen to music and everything. But I noticed as we went down to French Quarter, there are all kind of really neat shops in the French Quarter, antique shops, memorabilia shops, what have you, that were always closed when we went down to French Quarter. So our last day there, our plane didn't leave till the evening. And I said, well, let's spend the day. We'll go window shopping in the French Quarter. And that's like a fun night. It's a kind of, you know, they kind of give you something to do that day. So we did. We went to a lot of antique stores, went to memorabilia stores. And we finally got to Royal Street. Now, Royal Street in New Orleans at this time was all art galleries. Yeah. And that was fun. They had some beautiful paintings by some people I knew. I'm not know much about art. I'm not an art official. I don't really know much about it. But I recognize these people. They're famous. I recognize. But I noticed that we walked down Royal Street. The galleries are getting smaller, and the painters more obscure. But we finally get to the end of Royal Street, and there's a low art gallery. It's a two-story gallery. You walk in the front door. It's that modern art upstairs. My wife's a fan. I never have been. I always think it's junk art, but I don't have. I'm not an art aficionado, so I can't really say for sure. But I never cared for modern art. So she went upstairs. I'm just walking along the first floor, and there's paintings, and I don't recognize any of the paintings, recognize any of the artists. I'm walking along, and I get to the corner. There's a portrait standing on the easel, and I pop and give it a glance, and I stop like I ran into a glass wall. I just froze.
Wow.
I turn around and look. It was the portrait of the hunchback woman.
Okay.
Now, let me tell you something. In 38 years in the police department, I was in a lot of frightening, scary situations, a lot of them. But when you're in scary situations in the police force, you have training and experience to fall back on. You know what you should do and what your best procedure should be. In this case, I had nothing to fall back on. I didn't know what to do. I just look, and there's a pain. The emergency just stumble on. Onto it by accident in New Orleans. They're not. It's impossible. And I tell myself, I'm trying to rationalize this, because I'm frightened. I'm really frightened because I don't think this is reality. Something's wrong. I'm kind of going with the idea of maybe I'm not here. I'm in a nursing home or a hospital. And because things like this happen in, you know, movies and books. They don't happen in real life. I'm sorry, they just do not happen to people. And I'm trying to figure out what. How could this be? And I thought, well, maybe, but this is not the painting. It looks like a painting. It looks like it's not. But again, like I said, I closed my eyes. I could see a brush stroke. And I knew this was, I didn't know what to do.
Wow.
I'm just standing and looking at this thing and thinking, how can this be? How can this be? It's not possible.
But you knew it was real.
I was standing looking at this thing for 4 or 5 minutes. The salesman says, gee, I bet you're thinking how nice I look over your fireplace. I'm thinking, yeah,
I'm decorating an early hunchback.
I want a picture of a hunchback with my backyard. Yeah, who's the artist on this? So he said, well, come over here. I have a little bio of him. So he took him over to his desk, sat over to the desk, pulled out his name was J. Carroll Beckwith. And I started looking at the bio, and I saw immediately five things about Beckwith I had seen in the regression. For one thing, there actually was a portrait of a hunchback woman. And of course, I said what his date of birth and death. He was born in 1852. He died in 1917. I remember myself hypnosis at 1917.
Yeah.
And also that he lived during a time when I had seen the regression during the late. I lived during the 1800s, early 1900s, a time where there would have been carriages and gas lights, and that he had spent some time in France. I remember telling Dark Griffith that we were in France, and that he had won a number of awards for his painting. And I again recalled the scene where I was at a party and everybody's congratulating me. But again, I thought, Bob, come on, this is just silly. That you've seen this painting somewhere before, and yes, you've seen this blurb somewhere before. That's how you knew these things. But again, because I kept on writing to myself, how is it possible? Because this happening are about 250 million.
They're more than that. The odds of that happening, no.
I said, you know, the Powerball odds are 250 million to one, but still people win it, don't they? I'm thinking that's all it is. This is one wild, wild thing. Because, again, you're not ready to accept stuff on, so this is flimsy.
Robert, let me ask you, how many art galleries have you been in where you've come across a portrait of a hunchback woman? Seriously, I mean, if you go to, I've been, art galleries all over Europe, the Far East, United States, and that is not a subject that you see very often. I mean, Toulouse-Lautrec may have done some of it, but outside of that, not at all.
Exactly. But I'm telling myself, I'm trying to figure out what the odds. But I remember telling myself, well, people win the Powerball, that's 250 million. That's all this is. This is a bizarre chance thing. But the nice thing is now I had a name. I knew I could go back to Indianapolis and I could research it. And then I remember where I saw this at. Obviously, this was a small gallery. It's painting. It probably been somewhere I'd saw in Indianapolis. And I'd seen this blurb. And that's why I knew those things. But I thought, well, I'll take it back to Indianapolis. I'll go do some research. So I did. I went back to Indianapolis, immediately went to the library, and I found that there was actually very, very little information about Beckwith. I mean, he wasn't a famous painter. He never painted any masterpiece paintings you'd recognize. Most of his life, he painted portraits because he could sell those and make money. He painted other things, but he really couldn't sell them. Mm-hmm. He really had very much luck painting landscapes and selling them. But he could always make money painting portraits. So anyway, I go to the public library, and I didn't have very much at all. So the lady there said, you need to go to the Art Museum library. They have a much more extensive art history library up there at the Art Museum. So I did. I went to the Art Museum, and the librarian there was very nice. She helped me, and she found a bit, maybe a half page total of stuff I'm back with. And the interesting part is everything I found was another confirmation of what I'd seen. This is starting to bug me a little bit. For example, I found a Beckwith. I said when I went through the roof after I died, that looked like it was fall. Well, he died in October. And I said that when I went to the roof, there was lights to the horizons. Well, he died in New York City. And also said some quotes there from it. Said he didn't like that he painted portraits, but he didn't like painting portraits, but he did it because he needed the money. He didn't like painting the portrait, but he needed the money. And also said that his paintings were full of sun and bright color. And I remember the one over the fireplace that had a bottle and fruit and a big sun in the background. And then said, now this is starting to bug me again. I'm thinking, I've seen this exhibit. So wait, told me, said, by the way, so I have a folder for an exhibition of Beckwith's work that was held right here in Indianapolis. That moment, it was like, oh, my God, I finally figured it out. Now I got it figured out. Hey, I saw it during this exhibition. So she brought the folder to me. Unfortunately, the exhibition took place in 1911. I said, there have been, I told her, no more exhibitions, more recent ones. She says, no. She says, come on. She says, he wasn't that good a painter. She said, and there's not that much interest in his work. He's not that much of a painter. But interesting enough, on one of the little bits of information she found, come from a book, and it was a footnote. And it said, this information comes from the diaries of J. Carroll Beckwith that are on file at the National Academy of Design in New York City. So I knew then, as a police detective, I knew exactly what I had to do next. I had to get these diaries. I said, this is it. So I went home, and I got a contact. I contacted National Hand Design in New York City and asked them about the diaries. I'd like to see them. Is it possible to view the diaries? They said, oh, no, they're too much, too fragile. I said, we don't allow them ever to go out. They said, however, they have been microfilmed, and you can get copies of microfilmed for the Archives of American Art at the Smithsonian. So I went back to the library, and I requested the library transfer the information I wanted to get. The microfilm of his diaries. So I ordered them to the library in maybe about 2 weeks. So before they came in, I thought, I need to do something. I sit down and listen to my tape again. I wrote down everything I'd said during the regression to Beckwith that could be proved or disproved. I found there were 28 things I had said or experienced during a time that could be proved or not proved. So about 2 weeks later, the library...
This for me, and, you know, we only have a couple minutes left, but if people read your book and then they go and do a little bit about what you said today, and they're going to see the picture of that hunchback woman, and when they see that picture, they're going to know that it's not your average picture. It is very unique, right? I mean, when you say hunchback, you think of the hunchback of Notre Dame. That's not this picture. And for you to have that kind of visualization of a picture that is uncommon to the way hunchback gets described, I'm telling you, if I'm you, I'm shocked. I know we've got short time, and I just want to thank you so much for joining us here. But I want people to know, how do they get your books? How do they find out about you, Bob?
It's available on Amazon. It's available on the Internet. Let me just say one last point.
Sure.
I got the diaries from Beckwith. Turned out there were 17,000 pages. He had kept a diary from age 19 to the day before he died at 65. And I was able, through the diaries, to prove all 28 facts, every single one. Every single one of the facts I had seen during the regression, I was able to prove through the diaries.
Yeah.
That was an awakening moment when I found I couldn't find one fact that things I'd said or seen that wasn't true. That, to me, that was, I don't know, that was a revelation to me.
I want to tell everybody, they can find a synopsis of this, what you've said, with images if they go to reincarnationresearch.com. Because there, when I went and I looked, I had not heard your description of it. These are not normal images that you could kind of make up and think, I saw that. Robert, thank you so much. Mark?
We will be back next week, and we'll be taking calls from listeners. I'm the psychic. I'm here with the doc. I want to thank our special guest, Robert Snow, reincarnation expert and experiencer.
Yep.
And we will see you next week, same Transformation Network time, same Transformation Network channel. Thank you, everybody. God bless.
And don't forget, Google Robert Snow. You will get everything, including a video. Thank you. Thanks, Bob.
Hey, everybody. Thank you for tuning in to The Psychic in the Dark with Mark Anthony and me, Dr. Pat Besbilly, right here on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Hey, look, come back next week so we can explore with you more of life's many challenges and learn from fascinating guests. And you know what? Even Mark and me. We'll connect you and discover insights from people in this life and from the afterlife. Extraordinary problems? Yeah, they do. They require extraordinary solutions. But step into the world of possibilities with us on The Psychic and the Doc. That's every Thursday, 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on TransformationTalkRadio.com. That's TransformationTalkRadio.com. And don't forget, we're also live face-to-face on Facebook.com. Transformation Talk Radio.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and not necessarily those of KKNW, its management, or other advertisers. Contests are the responsibility of the host of this program, and not KKNW. This is Alternative Talk 1150 AM, KKNW Seattle, and KNUC 98.9 HD3 Seattle.
And good Tuesday to you. Benny Mathers here for a look at your alternative talk AM 1150 traffic update for around the town. Well, looks like I-5 southbound in the south end around Silicon and Lakewood. We have an emerging issue around the 520 interchange, pardon me, the 512 interchange. A little further up on 405 northbound, it's heavy still out of those S-curves. Just briefly around Park Drive, smooth out as you're approaching up through the Kennedale Hill and smooth up to the I-90. Stay tuned. Coming up next, after the news and weather, it's another hour of the Transformation Talk Radio Network. This time, well, I can pull that up. There it is. Pardon me. Forging a Life with Coach Christine Clark. Beyond the Curve, calling in your unique destiny. Stay tuned. NBC News Radio, I'm Lisa Taylor. President Biden is updating the nation this hour on the Russia-Ukraine crisis that follows the insertion of Russian troops into two breakaway regions of eastern Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin declared the regions independent and said his troops would be acting as so-called peacekeepers. Ahmaud Arbery's parents are celebrating after the hate crime trial of their son's killer yielded guilty verdicts. Arbery's mother, father, and lawyers came out of the courtroom with their hands raised in victory after the guilty verdicts were read. Attorney Ben Crump says he expects full justice for Arbery's family, meaning both civil and criminal victories. Former President Trump says Russia would never have invaded Ukraine if he was still president. Speaking on the Clay Travis and Buck Sexton show, Trump said Russian President Vladimir Putin was smart to invade Ukraine under the pretext of a liberation.
You got to say that's pretty savvy. And you know what the response was from Biden? There was no response.
The ex-president said he knew Putin wanted Ukraine years ago and told Putin, in his words, you can't do it. Trump added, Putin is invading now because he thinks President Biden is weak. Authorities say two National Guard aircrafts have crashed at a ski resort in Utah. The Utah National Guard confirmed two Black Hawk helicopters were involved in a crash that took place during a training exercise. No crew members were injured in the accident, but the choppers suffered damage. The Utah National Guard said the incident is under investigation. U.S. Capitol Police are requesting help from the Pentagon ahead of a possible trucker convoy protest. The Pentagon said the D.C. Homeland Security and Emergency Management Agency and the Capitol Police have asked the D.C. National Guard to support traffic control points ahead of President Biden's State of the Union address next week. Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby said the request is being analyzed by the Defense Department. Area law enforcement agencies say they have multiple reports of truck drivers possibly planning to protest vaccine mandates by blocking roads in major U.S. cities. If approved, the request would be one of the first times the law created to make it easier for U.S. Capitol Police to request National Guard assistance is used. You're listening to the latest on NBC News Radio.
For the next few moments, KKNW will be conducting a test of the emergency alert system. This is only a test. Feeding tones were a test of the emergency alert system. In the event of an actual emergency, information and directions would follow. This concludes this test of the emergency alert system. The views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of KKNW, its management, or other advertisers. This program is sponsored by Dr. Pat Mathilly and Transformation Talk Radio.
Welcome to Forging a Life, Beyond the Curve, calling in your unique destiny with Coach Christine Clark. Imagine you are a ball of steel, smooth, small, and cool to the touch. Your very being is softened by fire as you take hits that shape you. Christine is a transformational life coach dedicated to empowering entrepreneurs to create a whole life success on their terms. On this show, you will be forged into a magnificent, powerful, highly functional work of art that is your significant life. Now, here's your host, Christine Clark.
Join me, Coach Christine Clark, as we forge our lives. We are going to go beyond the curve and call in your unique destiny. Who will you be when you believe you have what it takes?
Well, hello, hello. I am Coach Christine Clark. Glad to be with you here today on the fourth Tuesday of the month. What is it needed to have what it takes, to believe that you have what it takes? You know, life is happening, and how do we switch from overwhelm into action? And that's what we're going to talk about today. You know, to get beyond the curve, to call in your destiny, it requires belief. Belief that you have what it takes that you can hang in there. And, you know, we're molded from birth, and we plan, or sometimes we don't plan, to live meaningfully. And yet through life, there are processes that shape and that hone us and refine us and to become the beautifully highly effective works of art that we are. And there's purpose in every phase for us. And so today we're going to just kind of walk through those. I want to let you know that there is a giveaway, a laser coaching program to blaze in 2022. Just send me your email, your name, your phone number, and email to me at Christine@sunglowtransformation.com. The winner is going to be selected on March 1st, so get your entry in by the end of the month, which is the 28th. And you get to hear the very first public announcement of a retreat. So save the date for a deeply transformational retreat in September, the 22nd through the 25th of 2022. You will vision. You're going to call up strength within. You're going to blast through your sabotage to burn bright in the world at the Blaze Retreat. And this fully experiential retreat includes hand forging. And I'm just so tickled to be able to offer this, that each person will be able to make a simple piece using fire, tongs, and a hammer. So save the date, September 22nd to 25th. You know, in the initial forging, the making the katana, the bar gets drawn out. It gets brought up from just being a chunk of steel into a long, drawn out piece that is the beginning of a katana. And in that initial forging, you know, the smith has to put it into heat to get it hot to make it malleable. We as human beings are malleable. We are soft, we're easily shaped, and we're impressionable and imprintable. You know, think back to your earliest childhood memories. And in our childhood, there are some internal blocks to our beliefs and our values and our drivers. Everything is formed. When we are very impressionable, and as we go through life, some of the things that solidify serve us and some of it doesn't. But I think back to, you know, growing up, what were some of the simple things, like learning to ride a bike? I remember learning to ride a bike. And for me, it was a solo venture. I put the bike on the street and pushed off from the curb and tried to keep balance and pedal a little bit and then would run back into the curb and did that process again and again and again. So over the course of maybe 2 or 3 hours in an afternoon, I learned to ride a bike. As the arcs away from the curb got longer and longer, I was able to maintain balance and pedal the bike at the same time. And think about those things when you grow up. What kinds of memories do you have? What solidifies for you? Do you remember being disciplined? Do you remember if it meant something or what you got in trouble for or what you didn't get in trouble for? I have a clear vision in my head of being spanked once when I was in the garage and having an arm held and my hand going back to protect my bottom. And I remember the being spanked, but I have no clue what it was spanked for. That piece of the memory is gone, but the actual act hangs in there. And there are different pieces that we put together from our memories. Like for me, getting the high school, the lead in the high school play, the part required emotion. And as we were doing the readings, I thought back to having recently lost a pet. I brought forward that emotion, and I was able to cry at the appropriate time during the reading, and I got myself the lead in the play, and that was really exciting to have happen. What kinds of things have you done where you have stepped up in power, stepped up in confidence, and what kind of solidification in what you when you were little? One time, the other piece for me, one of the other memories that surfaces, as I'm going through thinking, what am I going to talk about today? Want to bring up these memories. And popped into my head, junior high, having a bag full of candy brought to school to give away to people on my birthday, and having one particular boy in homeroom session get much more of the candy than he probably should have. I should have given him one piece. He was kind of cute, but nobody I really liked. And then I kept giving him the candy until finally at some point I said no. But it was because I didn't learn yet how to set boundaries, hadn't learned how to say no, hadn't learned how to draw the line when someone else was making a request in junior high. You know, those kinds of things are what we remember, and then we can draw meaning from those. But there's also so much that we don't remember that are influences in our lives. We learn by osmosis from our parents, from the media, from the cartoons we watch, from the school we went to, the climate we lived in, the food we ate. You know, I've come to the conclusion that whatever brand of something you ate as a child, you know, that becomes your standard for what is good, what is best. For us, there's a store brand of graham cracker that we like, and we've tried the name brands, and the flavor wasn't good, the texture wasn't good, but we did that. And that's part of learning through osmosis. So we learn and we are malleable, and it carries through. And I'm driven to guide other people in their initial formation of those memories to go back to where they started and reveal the heroic takeaways. So when you are shaking loose the disempowerment, sometimes we carry forward into adulthood things that we learned as kids that don't serve us anymore, to be able to call in the capacity and the ability that each of us has. That lights me up. I love taking something that is a memory that was disempowering and going back into the core, the root of it, rewriting that story, and then pulling out the greatness that comes from that. That, there's nothing like that. Nothing like that to shift the power of a memory, of a thought, of something that happened as a child and transform it for something that is, I am not valuable or I was not valued, to I have value, I have meaning, this gave me strength. That is the best. You know, the bottom line is that there is empowerment in the purpose and the meaning of all our experiences. Now we're going to take a break. And what does it mean to be intentional? How can you set yourself up to succeed? You know, what is in the pre-curve? And that's what we're going to talk about when we come back. I'm Coach Christine Clark. You can find me on my website, sunglowtransformation.com. You can find me on LinkedIn, YouTube, Instagram, and Facebook at Coach Christine Clark and Sunglow Transformation. Remember to sign up for the laser coaching program to Blaze in 2022. There are 4 focused private sessions with me, Coach Christine. All you have to do is send your name, your phone number, and email address to me, Christine@sunglowtransformation.com. The winner will be selected on March 1st. We'll be right back after this break.
Imagine what it would be like to turn your pain into purpose. Tune in to Transformation with Martinet every second and fourth Friday at 10 a.m. Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Martinet and her guests are here shining their lights today through empowering stories of hardship and transformation. Begin to see your life in a new light. Visit MartinetEmmons.com and tune in every second and fourth Friday at 10 a.m. Pacific to Transformation with Martinet. You're driven, and it totally shows. Your career is taking off. You're killing it in the mom game. But did your health needs make it on the plate this week? Tune in to the Boss Up Babe radio show, where Carissa Adkins helps babes show up, boss up, and thrive. Every second and fourth Tuesday at 12:30 p.m. Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Become the boss babe you were meant to be. To sign up for one of Carissa's group coaching programs, visit 365dailyhustle.com.
Optimize your breast cancer screening without any radiation or pain. Effective.
sensitive and widely used thermal imaging in Europe is now available to you here in the U.S. Using state-of-the-art FDA-approved camera, Eastside's first and only breast thermography clinic is now open in Bellevue. Safe, sensitive, low cost, no referrals needed. Contact Holistic Medical Center at 425-451-0404 or on the web, drdarvish.com.
We figured by the time we turned 50, we kind of had life figured out, but we were not prepared for the realities of midlife. Tune into And That's When I Realized, the truth and comedy of midlife, with me, Susan Dolce,
and me, Leon Dyer, every second and fourth Thursday at 1 p.m. Pacific from TransformationTalkRadio.com. You're not alone in these challenges, and sometimes you just gotta laugh.
Find us at SusanDolce.com
and LeonDyer.com.
Tune in to the Sacred Attunement Show with Asher Countryman, unlocking the power of mind, body, soul abundance. Tune in every first and third Friday at 2 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Join Asher as she guides you to sacred attunement. Align your mindset and your actions to master your life's purpose. Discover more at sacredattunement.com.
When trauma is stored in the body, it can subconsciously affect and determine our life experience. Learn how the mind connects with the body and how you can pursue your own healing and growth so that your line shines brighter than ever. On the Law of Attraction Traction with host, my mom, Green Beerfield. Every third Tuesday of the month at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern on TransformationTalkRadio.com. To learn more about Karine and her services as a holistic heart-centered counselor, visit KarineBeerfield.com.
Back. Are you a planner? You know, I love planning and organizing. That's kind of one of my things. Recently, got a new bed, and with that, rearranged the entire bedroom. We have a knocked out a wall. We've got two rooms that became the bedroom. My office is at one end, and when brought in a new bed, moved everything. And I got out the grid, paper, made all the little paper cutouts for the footprint of all the different sizes of what the bed is and the dressers and the desk and the filing cabinet, and figured it out where it all goes. I love doing the planning, and then of course then you have the grunt work of actually doing the moving. But in the making of the katana, the Japanese style sword blade, there is the pre-curve, and that is when the smith sets the blade up to put on the edge. And it's put into curve. You can kind of see that. This is the point. And the real cool thing about this is the edge is actually the inside of the curve. Because as the material is hammered down and the bevel put on, it straightens the blade. The material has to move somewhere. And when you pre-curve it, as you put the edge on, then you come up with a straight piece for the edge. And so it's planning. Howard, my husband, the smith, it's intentional. There is a plan. There is a purpose to the pre-curving. And for us, what does it look like to be intentional? Intention starts with vision. There has to be a vision. If you don't conceptualize what your desired life is, what you want to create, it's extremely difficult to obtain. In my life, I felt that there was mostly what I was doing was the next thing and the next thing and the next thing, what was expected. And I didn't really learn about visioning until I was in my late 40s. So you don't want to just say that I want something better, but to define in detail what better was. What does it look like? What does it sound like? What does it feel like? What does it taste like? What does it smell like? And when I learned all that, it was a revelation that by getting crystal clear on the desire, the destiny, the outcome, the goal, then I could call it in. I could bring it into me. And that's what the pre-curve is setting it up so then you can take the steps to bring it to fruition. So maybe you're like one of the millions of people out there that want a better relationship. So you have to define better. And I'm a little bit of a hard butt on this because clarity is king, and I will push for clarity. What does better mean? Well, does it mean that I can speak honestly and openly? Does it mean I am fear-free in my relationship? Does it mean there's laughter in the relationship? Does it mean we have sex four times a week? Define it. Get clear. Get crystal clear on it. And then when you define it, then you can bring it in. It's, you're set up with a pre-curve. You know what you're shooting for. Now you can have a plan and put together a plan. For me, part of my growth in deepening my relationship with my husband was to learn to speak up, speak my truth, to answer honestly rather than with an answer that was protecting him, protecting me, not having to face what was. And we've been doing this for a lot of years. Came up just recently. We have different opinions about cookware and what cookware should be used for and which pieces should be used for what. I want him to not fry, deep fry in the Teflon pan because those extreme temperatures in Teflon make the Teflon come off. Something that I think everybody should know and should just know, right? You don't do that. Recently, there he was cooking and fried chicken in the Teflon pan. And I said, Teflon's not for frying. He came back and asked me if I was angry. And so in honesty, because I've been working on this, I was able to say, yeah, I felt a little angry. I felt a little irritated. This has been something that's been kind of a thing for a long time. Then he was able to say, I feel like I don't do anything right. And so then we managed the conversation. That was not my intention, but my goal is to answer honestly, and because I'm practicing this. And so we had a great exchange after that, both of us clarifying and understanding in the moment. That's the work, to do it in the moment for us. Maybe you want to improve your workflow. Maybe you want to define, you know, so define what is improvement, what's better. Maybe there's a lot of fires, brush fires, people coming and needing this or needing that throughout the day, and you're not getting an opportunity to work on your project. You're not able to focus on these bigger things because you're doing all the little stuff. So what is your goal? Well, I want fewer brush fires. I want to spend more time on my projects. Great. Now you have an idea about what you want. You're in the pre-curve, you can plan. So maybe just set the first hour of the day to focus on your project work, because then, you know, after that, you can answer the phone or look at the email, but not the first hour. Or if stuff comes up right in the beginning of the day, set a time limit. I will only do this for so long, and then after lunch, I'm taking time to work on my projects. When you know what it is that you desire and get crystal clear on it, that makes the stepping into planning so much easier because you've got something you're shooting for. You know, the clarity on desired outcomes really leverages your actions. Working with a client that was having some pretty severe burnout, and she was working from home and wasn't giving herself time to be away from work. Start early in the morning, work through the day, work through her lunch, work late, and it was really causing deterioration in her health, in her sleep pattern, in her relationship with her kids. And so we had to define, what is it that you want? Well, I need rest. I want to honor my body and take care of it. So, great. Now we have the intention, what can do that? She started taking her full hour lunch. She started setting a timer. When the timer goes off in the evening, she left work and left it for the next day. And so once you get clear on what it is you want, it helps. You know, whether you are a, you know, maybe you're a financial advisor and you want to meet with people, and you want to keep up with both the current and potential clients? When do you take time to set those appointments? What works in your schedule? What is it important? Well, it's important to do these calls every single day. Great. What part of the day gets that done for you? Is that a first thing in the morning so it's done and checked off? Or is it an afternoon, maybe when your energy is lighting and it's easier to reach out and leave messages for people and to connect with people? What works within your environment? And that's part of just the pre-curve, being able to get a vision, clarify the vision, and then set up for success. So then you can take those steps as the hammer tracks along and puts the edge on, straightens the blade, puts the edge, and you can do the same thing in your work by planning, making steps, going forward, and always just taking the next step. What makes sense? This is what I want. How do I achieve that? I had a client with an architect. A lot of work, would continually get stressed out because of the volume of work he was doing. And it's like, okay, is it the number or the type of jobs? He realized that it was the smaller little jobs, the decks, the tiny pieces, want to shift a wall, one thing within, and those small jobs were more energy and less satisfaction. He thrives on being able to creatively figure out large sections like additions or new construction fitting within the city codes. And so how do we achieve that? If you want fewer of small projects, you want more big projects, you want to thrive on the puzzle, figuring things out, what does it take to do that? And what he was able to learn is that I need to raise my prices. I need to put my pricing to a point where the small jobs, those people are not going to want to spend that much money with me to figure it out. And also learning to be able to say, I am booked. I am to the max of what I can handle. It's going to be a few months or 3 months. And by able to be honest with people about the time frame, a lot of that extra work that was stressing him out just went other places, and he's still to full capacity. When you can get an idea about what you want and have a vision, then the clarity, the forward motion, the possibilities get really clear piece within the pre-curve for you. You know, to have a detailed vision clarifies your actions to take. And then you can plan and give yourself a framework to move in the direction of your desires. We're going to take a break here. And do you ever feel like you're wading through molasses, holding on to thoughts and ideas or grudges that are hampering your progress? You know, when would you be able to let go of release, and if you didn't have those, what flow you could create in your life? And that's what we're going to talk about when we come back. I'm Coach Christine Clark. You can find me on the website, sunglowtransformation.com. I'm on LinkedIn, YouTube, Instagram, Facebook at Coach Christine Clark, Sunglow Transformation. Remember to sign up to win laser coaching program, the Blaze in 2022. Send me your name, your phone number, and your email address to Christine at sunglowtransformation.com. The winner is going to be selected March 1st. You're going to get 4 private sessions with me to really work through whatever your blocks are and set you up to just really soar in 2022. Look forward to working with you. We're going to take a break, and then we'll come right back.
Have you heard about shifting the collective vibration and consciousness on the planet? Join me, Kimberly Barrett, on the Sharing Love and Light show every first and third Tuesday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern at TransformationTalkRadio.com to explore the depth of vibration and consciousness on our planet and learn how you can shine your love and light. To learn more, visit sharingloveandlightshow.com.
Healing has a ripple effect. One person's healing affects everyone around them. This is where the power of sharing our stories can be so important. Tune in to Playing on the Edge Radio with Megan Edge each month on Transformation Talk Radio as Megan provides you with ways of sustaining radical and powerful changes in your life. Enact the power of radical change. To find out more about Megan Edge, visit her website at meganedge.ca.
Tune in to Knowledge Book Radio with host Marge Potasek the fourth Tuesday each month at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Through many experiences, Marge was led to the Knowledge Book, a gift to humanity in its transition to the Golden Age that provides truth and answers. She now shares information from the Knowledge Book with you monthly on TransformationTalkRadio.com on Knowledge Book Radio. For more information, visit usa.theknowledgebook.com.
Hi, everyone. I'm Dr. Pat. I'm the host of the Dr. Pat Show, and I am the creator of the Transformation Network, doing what we do in the world of positive radio, informed, educated, positive media. Independent radio hosts and independent networks have been the face of positive messaging over the past decade. So all of us here have decided we're going to put together an independent network that is going to enable people to bring their positive message of hope, inspiration, and conscious action to the forefront. Help us create a future of amazing, uplifting stories that can be told so we can tell our children and they can tell their children of what hope and conscious action is all about. I want to thank you all for tuning us in, turning us on TransformationTalkRadio.com.
Feeling stuck? Journey into a new exciting reality today. Join Coach Christine Clark as she helps you forge the life you desire through processes that shape, hone, refine, elasticize, and transform you. Go beyond the curve and call in your unique destiny. Tune into the show, Forging a Life, live every fourth Tuesday at 11 a.m. Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com. To work with Christine, visit SunglowTransformation.com.
This is Coach Christine Clark, and this is Forging a Life, going beyond the curve and calling in your unique destiny. Grinding clean is one of the steps within making the katana, and because the forming of the katana, there are still going to be some hammer tracks, and you want to smooth out all the surfaces, take away the unevenness. The human equivalent is for us releasing what does not serve us, letting go, getting rid of what slows us down, smoothing our path. You know, to grind clean, the blade has to be pressed against coarse grit belts of the grinder, and the steel easily releases the excess. As the high spots meld with the low surfaces, the blade becomes smooth, it becomes flat, and the true profile is revealed. You know, what are the pieces that are holding you back, that are preventing flow for you? You know, what takes away time and energy from what is desired, what you want? Are you putting priority on your children or maybe an aging parent or a friend that's focused on drama? You know, to continually drop everything and to answer the call or answer their call or give your time and energy always to them. You might be sacrificing some of your own needs. You might be sacrificing some of your own desires and doing it in the guise of supporting others. It's a good, sexy excuse to be able to put other people first and focus on them. But if we do that too much, we're not moving forward for ourselves, creating the life that we want, where we get to shine. You know, when I was running a direct sales business, I was also managing my husband's business, managing the sword business. And I would do everything and anything, you know, for him and for his business. I was the chief financial officer. I was the administrative assistant. I was the travel agent. I was the customer care officer, as well as being a full-time mom. I was the chief bottle washer, kept the house clean, so that all he needed to do was go to the shop and produce the blades. And my business, I was also running a business, my direct sales business, was almost always a last priority. You know, I had to release the caretaker to embrace my own value. And when I moved into coaching, that became so much easier for two things. One is, as a coach, I was really fulfilling my call in life. Everything I had learned and experienced through my whole life, running multiple businesses, fed into being the coach that I am, having the acumen to help others and move them forward. And it lit me up. I loved coaching. I loved coaching. And really, there's a passion there. And so the passion itself allowed me to focus time on me and my business and make it a priority. And consequently, doing coaching, having a coach, doing transformational work on myself as well as with others allowed me to get clear on how to go about that, clear on how to let go, clear on letting my people around me, my children, my spouse, take on more responsibility, that it wasn't up to me to care for everything all the time. And that was huge. In corporate America, we can go in early, we can stay late, and to the detriment sometimes of our health and our mental well-being by putting in all the hours. And part of it comes from just having a really, really big workload. When I was in corporate America, I had a huge workload, and I would do the go in early, and I would use the come home late and really work hard. But also, it was a push to show up well, to perform well, to be seen. I had to earn my value over and over and over constantly, never assured that if I let down for a little bit that I wouldn't be slipping. But that drive to show up well at corporate took its toll on self-care, on health, on keeping the house up, on having energy for my spouse. I remember that I had a friend that had gone through the underwriting training with me, and she moved into human resources, and she called and wanted me to come over and spend some time with her on a weekend. And it was really cool, like, that she thought of me and wanted to connect. And I went over there, and we sat by the pool of her house, and I laid on that chaise lounge and fell asleep. And I was like the worst person to invite over to spend time with because I was not there present for her because I was so exhausted. It cost me a friendship. So then it's like, what's costing? What are happening? What do they have to let go in order to create flow? Well, one of the things I let go was that job to change the trajectory of my life. So what are you tolerating? When you think about it, what are you tolerating in your life? You know, then you, once you know what you're tolerating, then you can address the issues. When you think about what are the things that are taking up time, taking up energy, taking away from what I really want to create and have in my life, once you know that, then you can decide, okay, there is, it can be something simple, like just a small irritation. Does the door bang shut every time you go through it? Does it need the latch worked on? Do you have to pull the door shut and make sure it latches every time? Something little like that. But you can choose. Okay, once you realize you're kind of irritated or have some energy around it, what does it take to let it go? Well, you can decide, I'm not going to address it. It's there. I'm not going to take time to work on it. So I'm going to stop paying attention to it. It's called, you can decide to move on it now, move on it later, move on it never. And anyway, if it's moved on it never, then we also don't pay attention to it. remove the distraction. If there's something that's present that is taking time from you, taking energy from you, it's a distraction, but getting in the way of you being able to flow through your life. What is it that is? I remember having a client who had a smoke alarm where the battery had gone dead or was almost dead. And I talked with this person every 2 weeks, and I remember hearing the beeping while we were on the phone together. And then after a couple of 3, 4, 5, 6 sessions, I remember saying, what is that? Well, it's a smoke alarm. It needs to be replaced. And I had to ask her, I said, would you be willing to take that down and put a new battery in that before our next session? And when I made the request, she did it. What was interesting to me is that something like that, the piercing beep regularly with a smoke alarm, has energy, put energy into the room. And yet it became a background thing that she was not noticing, but once she replaced the battery, it was silent. She told me that there was an edge of vibration that had been present in her life that was gone because it was there. And that's what some of our tolerations can be. So the grinding has to take being aware of it so then you can make a choice to release it. Grinding on the blade takes abrasion and pressure, and it creates heat and leaves a smooth surface. For us, it takes awareness and then choosing to create that smooth surface. And how do you do it? Do you address and fix the thing? Do you address and say what you need to say? Or do you say, you know, that is so small, I'm going to leave it, and I'm not going to put energy towards it? All of those things clear the path to create flow in your life. You know, and we deserve flow. You deserve flow. And when you release what does not serve you, your growth is in flow. And the time and the energy and the focus show up to quickly move you forward. You will have that fresh breath of clean air. And you'll wonder, maybe, why it took you so long to move on that thing. What you can celebrate is that you have the awareness and you did move on it, and now you have that fresh air, you have that flow, you're able to move forward, and that's worth celebrating. We're going to take a break here in just a minute. You know, the last change comes from internal transformation. And when there's internal transformation, the changes that are created there are the strongest, the most lasting. And what does it look like to have durable resiliency? That's the question. I'm Coach Christine Clark. You can find me on my website, which is sunglowtransformation.com. You can find me on LinkedIn, YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, at Coach Christine Clark and at Sunglow Transformation. Someone's going to get a laser coaching program to blaze in 2022. It could be you. Send your name, your phone number, and your email address to christine@sunglowtransformation.com. The winner will be selected March 1st, so get your entry in by February 28th at midnight. And also mark your calendars for September 22nd to 25th for the Blaze Retreat. And we're going to be right back after this last break.
Are courageously expanding love on my new show, The Elizabeth Cunningham Show, every Tuesday at 3 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Join me and my guests where we talk about relationships, sex, love, and the ways we wish we could be but never thought were possible. Visit ElizabethAnnCunningham.com and subscribe.
Are you feeling lost in this journey we call life?
When you awaken the truth of your patterns, limitations, and beliefs, you can start to heal relationship with yourself, others, and your circumstances. I'm Ritika Rose, life coach, author, and speaker. My mission is to help you align with your most powerful, authentic self and transform how you experience your inner and outer world. Find the confidence and peace to live the highest version of your life. Visit RitikaRose.com.
Life can be demanding, but sometimes our wheels are spinning and we're too focused on making them turn to notice we're stuck in the mud. Tune into The Pause with me, Ellen Wyoming Deloy, every second and fourth Tuesday at 9 a.m. Pacific on Transformation Talk Radio. Learn how to stop, reflect, and start moving forward with intention. And if you're really looking to jumpstart your personal development, schedule a free coaching consultation with me at ellenwyomingdeloy.com. Tune in to the Be Happy Now show with me, Claudia Sam. Flex your soul connection muscle and be your inner guide to fulfillment. Every Thursday on TransformationTalkRadio.com. You are here for a bigger reason and are worthy of accessing it. Experience happiness now. Tune in to your intuition and connect with me. Visit ClaudiaSamCoaching.com.
Want to ignite your best life full of joy, passion, and purpose? Then join me, Stephanie Jane, for The Spark, Wednesday nights, 6 o'clock Pacific Time, 9 o'clock Eastern, on TransformationTalkRadio.com, and learn how together we can illuminate the world. Learn more on StephanieJane.world. The best is yet to come.
Tune into Hungry for Answers every first and third Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific, 12 p.m. Eastern on TransformationTalkRadio.com with me, Robin Clare. I am a recovery coach, professional, and best-selling author, bringing you eye-opening conversations about addiction and groundbreaking tools for recovery. To learn about me and my offerings, visit Clarity.com. That's Claire, C-L-A-R-E, dash I-T-Y.com.
Coach Christine Clark, welcome back. This is Forging a Life, Beyond the Curve, calling in your unique destiny. I'm here every fourth Tuesday of the month, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern. One of the final steps in the making of the katana is the thermal cycling. And the greatest transformation that is attained is internal. And that's whether you're working with metal or working with people. You know, all of the steps that form the katana also create a really big, chunky internal microstructure in the steel. And if you think about having great big cinder blocks versus something like fine white sand, and the big cinder blocks within the microstructure of the steel aren't the best because they will promote the blade to crack or the blade won't hold its resiliency. It might not hold its edge as well. And so once it's done being shaped and formed and gorgeous on the outside, it goes through the internal transformation of thermal cycling by putting into a salt pot a giant tube of molten red hot salt, and it's dipped in there and then pulled out and dipped in and pulled out in that intense heat for periods of time and then allowed to cool and then go through the process again, break down and refine the molecules so that they become that fine sand, and which adds resiliency, toughness, edge-holding ability, and all of the pieces that you expect from a high-quality katana. And it provides exceptional strength and edge holding. And for us, change, internal change, transformation, for it to be permanent, we have to shift internally. That's where the greatest changes happen. And the internal shifts can happen in different ways. You can have it through just simple repetition. When you have muscle memory that's in your cells, that's transformation. That is something that you can hold on to. Do you remember learning to tie your shoes? I don't actually remember learning to tie my shoes, but I know I can just go and I tie my shoes and it's automatic. I don't even think about it. It just happens. I'm not a very athletic person, but dribbling a basketball, right? To learn how to dribble a basketball, first of all, you have to learn to bounce the ball and have it come back to your hand instead of running across the floor and going somewhere else. And so you practice dribbling the basketball, bouncing it, catching it, bouncing it, catching it. And then until you can continuously bounce it and have it stay with you. And then from there, you learn to move across the floor, to dribble and walk at the same time or move at the same time. And I watch a basketball game on TV, and it's like poetry, the way that people can move and handle and switch which way they're going, and the ball is always with them. That comes from practice, repetition, 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 until the body knows this, it owns this, it's in the cells, and it is not a conscious thought. You don't have to think about dribbling the ball. You think about the game, you think about the opponent, you think about all the other parts that bring, perform, I guess, high quality to the professional. If you're going to go out and network, same kind of thing. The first time you stand up and say who you are and what your company is and what you do, your palms are going to be sweaty. You may not speak as clearly as you want. You may not enunciate, and you might not look anybody in the eye. But as you continue to go out and learn to network and talk at different events, and you stand up, and then you learn to say who you are and what your business is and then what you do. And later you can learn to also switch not what you do, but what experience people have with you, draw them into you. And then as you're talking, you're saying what is comfortable, and you're talking about your business and drawing in energy and making eye contact. It all comes from repetition. And as you repeat the process, you hone the skill and it becomes muscle memory. That's an internal transformation. So anytime you start in a new venture or start something, it's going to be awkward until the repetition refines it and makes it smooth out, makes it work for you. The other type of transformation is the deep work of shifting beliefs and shifting drivers and shifting values. When you follow a disempowering belief down into its root and shift the story that was created there and bring forth the self-belief, bring forth the confidence, bring forth the worthiness. That's the work that I really relish doing. I like doing the deep work where we take someone and what is the block? And it goes back to an experience you had when you were little. And we look at that experience and we go back a little further and find the positive, find the happiness, and you can bring that forward. What is the interaction? What's the real truth that was in it? And what is the new meaning for them? That's huge. And I love doing that kind of deep work, because when you transform and shift and tell yourself a different story, an empowering story, then that is in your body. It is that deep shift that lasts, that sticks, that you can hang on to and go back to and anchor with. You know, when we think about spilling the milk and mom got angry and we decided that we were a klutz and we would never be graceful and we couldn't be a dancer and on, what happened was, you were a young child, the milk was really a big thing, and you spilled it all over the table. And mom was stressed because grandma was ill, and it had nothing to do with you. But we formed this idea, so we go back, and we really look at that event, and we shift to a new perspective, maybe the one that because you were independent and helpful as a child, that you had the milk, you were getting things for yourself to give your parents some space to deal with what they were dealing with. It all happens by going back through. And when you can get into that deep peace and shift, the transformation can be amazing. And the energy is huge. And it's so exciting. And it just lights everything up. You know, when we come up against hardship, when we have emotional strain, we can lose track of our abilities. We can get lost in what's going on and forget that we are resilient, that we are strong, that we are capable. We can step into this transformation with a coach by rewriting a disempowering story. We can step into transformation when life gives us hardship and suffering because we learn what we're capable of. You know, and we can choose to step into the unknown, to face our fears, or to do something we've never done before. That will bring us transformation. And when we stick with it until the end, when we master a skill, then we also have transformation. So there's transformation in all of these. And there is a quote that I wrote and have shared different people, but it is the hardest to believe that you have what it takes when you're in the struggle. And yet it is only in the struggle that you clarify and solidify that you have what it takes. And that's what the deep transformation is. So in the making of the katana, it's really orderly. You know, the smith starts with a bar of steel and the process is it until there's a katana. You know, in our lives, we can have any of the processes at any time, you know, and even multiple processes at the same time. You can be in the planning pre-curve, have deep transformation, be releasing what doesn't serve you, and still be influenced by your initial molding from a child. The truth in creating the katana provides a framework for understanding ourselves and the energies of life happening, and becoming takes effort and is a process. When you can trust the process, then you can believe that you really have what it takes. Thank you so much for joining me today. I hope that you had some great takeaways. Share them with me. I'm Coach Christine Clark. You can find me on my website, Sunglow Transformation. Look up me on social media at sunglowtransformation.com and also at Coach Christine. Someone's going to get a laser coaching program. Submit your name, your phone number, and your email address to Christine@sunglowtransformation.com. The winner will be selected March 1st. Until next time, keep forging your life.
Thanks for tuning in to Forging a Life with Christine Clark. Remember to acknowledge your talents and skills. Your gifts are the elements needed to claim the life of your dreams. Believe you have what it takes to forge the life you want. Through intuition, trusting yourself, and the process, take action and call your life into a vibrant, beautifully lit existence aligned with your core self. To learn more or work with Christine, visit sunglowtransformation.com.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and not necessarily those of KKNW.